consulter la page de Transit Secours Région Montréal, sheltermovers.com/donnez-montréal. Vous avez le courage de quitter, nous vous prêtons main forte.
Yo, check this out. This is Flavor Flav, and you listening to C. Yo, check 1-2. This is Flavor Flav, Public Enemy, and you listening to K. Yo, check 1-2. This is Flavor Flav, Public Enemy, and you listening to CKUT, and the place to be from the bottom of the POP.
Yes, 1-2-1-2. Oh yeah, C. Nomadic Massive in the place to be. You're listening to CKUT 90.3. Understand?
Welcome to the November 23rd edition of Dromotext.
And tonight we're going to be celebrating the work of U.S. poet Michael McClure. McClure was an important figure of the San Francisco Beat Movement. McClure was one of five poets who read at the famous San Francisco Six Gallery reading in 1955. The same reading Allen Ginsberg read one of his famous renditions of Howl. That reading was later fictionalized by Jack Kerouac as a scene in The Dharma Bums. McClure is known for a number of his poems, and especially the controversial play The Beard, that premiered in San Francisco in 1965 and was the object of concerted oppression by the San Francisco, Berkeley, and Los Angeles police departments at the time. McClure worked on a number of different collaborations with Ray Manzarek. He was also a close friend of Jim Morrison of The Doors. So we'll be listening to a series of his poems in this week's edition of Dromotext. Here's Michael McClure.
First one was written in the 50s, about the time of that first poetry reading that you spoke of earlier. That was the poetry reading that was said to begin the Beat Generation. That was October 12th, 1955. I was pretty young. I'd already met Allen Ginsberg, who was a little older than me, and Allen had met Gary Snyder, a great nature poet, and Philip Whalen, another wonderful nature poet and American poet who's now a Zen master at the Hartford Street Zen Center in San Francisco, a young surrealist poet, Philip LaMantia, and our master of ceremonies was the great anarchist philosopher poet Kenneth Rexroth. And he introduced us, and Allen read Howl. I read my first poems, the first poems that I read in public. It was also Gary Snyder's first reading. It was Phil Whalen's first reading. And I read a lot of poems about nature, including a poem for the death of 100 whales. And while we were giving this reading, Jack Kerouac was there in the audience shouting, "Go, go, go, go." And I met Jack that night, but I didn't really have a conversation with him till the next day when Ginsberg brought him over to my place and they had a little matchbox of marijuana. And we smoked that, became friends.
Here's a poem called Action Philosophy. That government is best which governs least. Let me be free of ligaments and tendencies to change myself into a shape that's less than spirit. Let me be a wolf, a caterpillar, a salmon, or an otter, sailing in the silver water beneath the rosy sky. Were I a moth or condor, you'd see me fly. I love this meat of which I'm made. I dive in it to find the simplest vital shape. Ah, here's the child. What's liberty when one class starves another? What's liberty when one class starves another? Thank you. That began with words by Thoreau. Here are some poems I wrote in 1962. I've been thinking a lot about these poems. There's 99 of them, and they come out of a religious experience I had. About the goddess who is coiled in the chakras at the base of our spine. and they came out in an invented language, a language of tantra, a language of spell to change, make changes in the universe. Here's number 58 of 99 of them. The dark blue snake flares up from the loins and lashes itself upon the muck-teed air, writhing the clouds of unspoken speeches and making fragrance of hemlock and copal. I see the lovers seated in groups upon the hillside. They converse in heroic whispers of Gruor and Toriz, reading their fates upon the scrolls, whose bare arms unroll them for the dimmed but bare and staring eye. In the garden, we are beyond such nonsense, and we smile. Ooh, ha, Tatoni, Mireb, no, oh, Grier. Gruor manes uncurl from our cheeks, and we know it, tha, oh. For Lawrence Ferlinghetti. For Lawrence Ferlinghetti. The cups we drink from are the skulls of Arabs. And this silk is the skin of babies. The frothing on our chins is not rabies, nor are our fingernails golden scarabs. We're normal human animals, and we itch like scabies for the rape of things. It is ordinary and beautiful to have the duty to twist and tease the lovely glimmering light we see in things. Then one day we look about and hope to put it back inside where once was fresh foam or moss. But we've made a cross of wings of birds and butterflies, and it can't lift off the ground or push into the soil. Where there was once a perfume smell of mulch, now there's petroleum stench turned inside out and fingerprints of brightness wiped away. What will we say to all the singing realms that try to rise inside of us? Grar. Here's number 51 of the 99. I love to think of the red-purple rose in the darkness cooled by the night. We are served by machines making satins of sounds. Each blot of sound is a bud or a star. Body eats bouquets of the ear's vista. Garbudi, eyes, ears, nose, deem thou, no, na, o, rurvor, na, garu, me, na, dru, search, na, thee. The machines are too dull when we are lion poems that move and breathe when we grur. Andri Maikta Sharu Sridano deemed as one Ethus Ro. Another poem for Allen Ginsberg, this one written while Allen was alive, called Grieved Skull. Oh, grieve. And by the way, I really held the skull in my hand like Yorick when I wrote this poem. I thought of Allen, because of Allen's obsession with death and life. Grieved Skull for Allen Ginsberg. Oh, grieved clown visage of human skull with pointed bony dome and deep-set eye sockets, black triangle nose and broken teeth that grin on nowhere emptiness. Your weight is like a football cupped between my palms. You are so light, so modest, and so small, not large with eyes and ears and chin, but solitary, like a blue-black swallow trembling in the wind. What serpent of nerve slid through the vertebra to uncurl in thee and unflex and open out into a rumpled butterfly of brain and forward-flapping wings? Wings of crumpled fields and nervous flesh on which were writ old loves and dripping hates. Here are the gates to smell of excrement within the sty, and strings of lute and juice of cherry. You grin, but you are not merry. What huge holes there are to hold the tiny eyes, and I rub my thumbs in them, and feel the smoothness of the socket bones with fear, and push my forefinger through the big round hole in the underside, and sense my heart twitch like swallow's wings as she sits in heavy wind upon barbed wire. It is not easy being on your own. It is not easy being who you are. Nobody knows. Nobody knows what huge holes there are to hold the eye. My finger finds the basal crest inside, the occiput in back, and it is the last divide of the brain's hemispheres, back here inside where the image of the midnight blue and orange breast of bird is slipped from the thing with dainty claws that feel the rust upon barbed wire. And it is made to be another part of self, not just a separate living thing. This is the future in collapse of yesteryear. Goodbye, bony Wednesday, who can hang a face on you? But still the taste of red-black cherries goes echoing through the skull. Inside of you are ragged thorns and thrones and saddles to hold the hands of thought. Outside, on the yellowed ivory shell, my thumbnail pressing hard can make these scratches. While the swallow peeps somewhere in chilling wind, you are the stuff of nowhere in this deepness, and that moves me while the swallow peeps somewhere in chilling wind. Another poem for Allen Ginsberg, this one written while Allen was alive, called Grieved Skull. Oh, grieve. And by the way, I really held the skull in my hand like Yorick when I wrote this poem. I thought of Allen because of Allen's obsession with death and life. Grieved Skull, for Allen Ginsberg. Oh, grieved clown visage of human skull, with pointed bony dome and deep-set eye sockets, black triangle nose and broken teeth that grin on nowhere emptiness. Your weight is like a football cupped between my palms. You are so light, so modest, and so small, not large with eyes and ears and chin, but solitary, like a blue-black swallow trembling in the wind. What serpent of nerve slid through the vertebra to uncurl in thee and unflex and open out into a rumpled butterfly of brain and forward-flapping wings? Wings of crumpled fields and nervous flesh on which were writ old loves and dripping hates. Here are the gates to smell of excrement within the sty and strings of lute and juice of cherry. You grin, but you are not merry. What huge holes there are to hold the tiny eyes, and I rub my thumbs in them and feel the smoothness of the socket bones with fear and push my forefinger through the big round hole in the underside and sense my heart twitch like swallow's wings as she sits in heavy wind upon barbed wire. It is not easy being on your own. It is not easy being who you are. Nobody knows. Nobody knows what huge holes there are to hold the eye. My finger finds the basal crest inside, the occiput in back, and it is the last divide of the brain's hemispheres, back here inside where the image of the midnight blue and orange breast of bird is slipped from the thing with dainty claws that feel the rust upon barbed wire. And it is made to be another part of self, not just a separate living thing. This is the future in collapse of yesteryear. Goodbye, bony Wednesday, who can hang a face on you? But still the taste of red-black cherries goes echoing through the skull. Inside of you are ragged thorns and thrones and saddles to hold the hands of thought. Outside, on the yellowed ivory shell, my thumbnail pressing hard can make these scratches. While the swallow peeps somewhere in chilling wind, You are the stuff of nowhere in this deepness, and that moves me, while a swallow peeps somewhere in chilling wind. A few haikus. Nothingness of intelligence, silver sunlight through closed eyelids. Pink Band-Aid stuck to the asphalt. Looks gray in moonlight while crickets sing. What soft brown eyes the dog has as she shits on the deer's hoof print. Hey, it's all consciousness, thumps of assault rifles and the stars. Oh, accident. Oh, perfect crushed snail, like a star gone out.
That's the way Kerouac wrote. It's that train of thought. It's the first thought, best thought, as Allen Ginsberg has told me. But people like Truman Capote say, he said, actually, and I may be paraphrasing,
that's not writing, that's typing.
Right.
That's what Truman Capote said about Jack Kerouac.
Yeah.
Well, you know, there's some truth to that.
But he didn't get it.
You know, a man as brilliant as Truman Capote might have gotten it. He might have been a little envious of it. You know, he's an extraordinary human being. But the reason that I think there is some truth to the fact that's not writing, that's typewriting, is that Kerouac was not trying to create literature. Kerouac was creating great art. He was creating poetry. He was creating a record. And one of the fine, great records of consciousness in words. But he was not seeking the goal of literature, and that may have been what made Truman Capote so uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. I mean, now after the fact, people say, "Oh yeah, Jack Kerouac's great literature," and Capote was looking for that distinction, and strongly seeking that distinction. I don't believe Jack was.
Yeah.
It's an award that's been given to him that's seen that way. Dolphin Skull, the poem. Is in two sections. Stanzas in Memory, in which I emulate Jackson Pollock's psychoanalytic drawings, and that I want to go to the unconscious and write directly and in projective verse as directly as it's possible to go while looking at scenes or imagery or sensory imagery in the unconscious. And I did 17 long stanzas like that, of energetic gazes into the unconscious. And then I realized the poem wasn't done. I took one of those long gazes into the unconscious, and I knew which one. It spoke to me. And I took that moment from the unconscious and made that moment as conscious as I possibly could by writing everything that took place in that moment. And I found that melded in that moment was everything from travels that I'd done in Tanzania and Kenya back to my infancy in Kansas to my childhood in Seattle to the experiences that I had in the 50s in San Francisco while I was being photographed by the photographer who furnished the cover photo of that book. It's a picture of me in the mid-1950s, about the time I wrote the last poem in the book. All of those things melded together into one moment. I saw that all moments are one moment, and in fact each moment is a great adventure, and that every one of us is alive in the same moment, and all that's happened is it's like a life spirit is changing masks. I'm me right now. You know, you're you right now. Somebody else is somebody else right now. But we're all sharing the same moment. And what we can do is give each other the experience or the pleasure or the fun or the fear or the hunger or the passion or the light-handedness or the lightheadedness or the pleasure of any given moment that we have. So it's a very long, musical, verbal recording of that moment. Well, I'm afraid a lot of poetry doesn't do that.
Well,
for me.
The good poetry.
The poetry that doesn't do that for me is the poetry that's, you know, proposed to me to be the contemporary. Well, first place, we're talking about contemporary poetry right now. We'll say that as an aside. So much of the poetry that proposes to me that it's literature, that it's high art, that it's a lot of things like that, is not doing it for me because it's following such a multitude of rules. The people who are doing it have their heads so boxed up, or they're so busily imitating someone else, or they're so busily concerned with whether this will be acceptable in a college classroom, or if they have students, what their students will think of it. That kind of writing is in such a sad wreckage of a prison that it doesn't do anything. But if you go to the poetry of people like Allen Ginsberg, of Gary Snyder, of Diane DePrima, of Ann Waldman, of Ed Sanders, of Amiri Baraka, if you go to those living, those vital poets, it is an adventure in consciousness because there's nothing held back. It is the highest form of art because they're not holding back. They're not being cowardly. They're not being niggardly. They're not saying we have to put the bounds on this. It's people who are letting, as far as possible, their deepest expressions and their deepest feelings, and even the feelings that they discover as they're writing the poetry. The poetry itself becomes a way of inventing the soul that they're trying to create. None of these people believe that we have a soul. I think that they all believe that we can create a soul. I think that they all believe that it doesn't do you any good when you have created one. It just complicates your problems. It gives you something more to write poetry about. It means you can taste the nectarine better. It means that you probably enjoy bungee jumping more if you're bungee jumping. So it just makes more problems, but we can't resist those problems.
Big, dumb, animal states. Eyes, ears, nose, love, hate, realms of blue velvet, all is surface. The mind heart is deep, dancing with shape, stealing selves, refinements of kiss and claw, fished from the river, lids half shut, buttercups close to the noise of the creek, mauve shooting stars with white and black faces, bend over sun cups, big, dumb, animal states. Splots of blood on asphalt by a burst of gray feathers. Simple stares of obvious deceit. Pleasure and triumph. Hair every which way. Social nature in boxes. Animal states, real in vacancy. Vacancy real in animal states. Sheer joy of swimming around in the infinite. Space between dendrites, floating in nothing. Nowhere is a place when even Dada fails. Bright seated figure on your lion throne. Let me enter a paradise of joy and pain in each supercluster of galaxies at the tip of a hair on the skin of a growing orange carrot, and be your cat who smiles from the stone wall. Better yet, compassion, kindness, and an ordinary drop of wisdom. Politics. In the mind, the compartments of pain are ruts. The personality is wrinkled like a nut and rippled with imagined griefs becoming real, but somewhere in the starving world, we must stretch out and feel the panhandler dying by the brick wall and scratch his black, greasy dog on the head. Otherwise, we are dead inside our music and satin rooms. We're so busy healing ourselves. We're so busy healing ourselves. But these compartments of pain in our heads are rifts in satin, while out there a revolution is dying to be born. and we must face, yeah, face the politics of the soul and feel the fur under our hand. Fly with the eagle and burrow with the mole. Here's what I often do with Ray Manzarek, Ray playing the piano and my reciting it. Called Lead Belly Blues. Lead belly blues get in my bones. I'm sick of old folks' tears and babies' groans. I'm chock full of this lion eating Rome. I'm going where the eagle is going. Zero America, I'm going home. I'll be where I hold my lover at night. My head's a hammer and my toes are stones. She's got a bed the color of a rose. Rain on the roof in the morning light. Lead belly blues get in my bones. Rain on the roof in the morning light.
These three poems are unchanged. They're spontaneously, and they are as they were written, and each one is a kind of a spiritual challenge. And part of the adventure of consciousness taking place there is that I may not change it. That is, I do not allow myself to change it. And that doesn't mean that it's a grueling or excoriating task that I've laid upon myself, but a very sweet possibility of taking a trip of through experience that I've never taken before. Now, the poem does not really necessarily come from me. With projective verse, the inspiration for the poem can be outside of you, and then or it could be inside of you. It could be a perception, or a memory, or a piece of consciousness. But it could also be, let's say, it was a vase of incredibly beautiful irises. Then I look at that vase of irises, or touch it, and I smell it. It's not just looking at it. I'm aware. I have the perception in the real world of that vase of irises. It becomes part of me as a physical being, and then it sort of like rebounds following my breath line onto the page. That is arranged on the page in terms of my breath line. And what I'm really listening to as I write it is not metrical foot, like, you know, A, B, light, heavy, light, heavy, light, heavy, or any given count, but I'm listening to the syllables as it happens. So you see, it's less like I'm dragging something up out of myself than it is like I'm acting in the world, like those painters I spoke of. Yeah, and I think Jackson Pollock was too, you know, the painter, the great drip and abstract gestural painter, gestural expressionist painter, or so's a man named Pete Vulkas, who was a man who changed ceramics from being a craft into being like a major experiential fine art by going to that same movement of body use that he found with the abstract expressionist painters like Jackson Pollock and Franz Kline and Willem de Kooning, if people know who those are. Well, here was this guy just a little younger than them, and he said, I'm going to do that with clay. And he began doing it with clay and making these huge clay figures. And so he changed everything. He's a scientist of meat, too. He was using his body in this struggle with, for, against, in love with, in joy of, maybe even a little hatred of clay, and created this entirely new acceptance of a new medium in the field of art. Now, that's science.
And meat.
He's using his meat.
Yeah.
He did performances. He'd be in a big struggle with a potter's wheel and huge pieces of clay that people were moving around for him. It's a very exciting thing.
Yeah.
And I guess since I first got to San Francisco when I was around 21, well, I guess I was about 20 years old, I've been associating a lot with friends who are biologists, botanists, ornithologists, psychiatrists, medical doctors, and sometimes combinations of all those things. So they've taken me out to, I have one friend who's a psychiatrist and a medical doctor and also the most extraordinary naturalist I've ever known in my life, exactly my age. And so we sort of grew up together experimenting with the psychedelics and then going out to the desert to look at the spring wildflowers and doing a little mountain climbing to see what was at the top of mountains and driving to the ocean and going down to Big Sur and learning what plants had what relationship to what animals and what birds and what flowers.
Plant intelligence, a naturopathic doctor friend of mine calls it.
Well, it's all intelligent.
Right, right.
If it's there, it's intelligent.
Right, right.
Here's one, when I wrote this, it was meant to be for Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill, but it doesn't seem to be needful for anybody. It's called Senate Hearings. It is almost beautiful when fraud and hypocrisy reach this peak and become exquisite. Exquisite in contempt for intelligence. With black faces or white faces, we are always this way, as if Freud or Whitehead had never been born, as if our most contemptible or laughable lies are the mountaintops of our aspirations. We are always this way, but these early years of the 90s make me feel creepy, as if I live in a movie with spittle, spewing, sneering, sullen, snide, plotting figures from the caricatures of Daumier and the nightmares of Goya. This poem is dedicated, it's called Souls, and it's dedicated to Ernesto Cardenal, the great guerrilla fighter and revolutionary theologist of Nicaragua. The souls have no value. They are fox furs that we drape over well-fed arms and shoulders. But still they are hard-earned and long-sought by those with the luxury and energy to torment and love them into being. Still, we are warm stones, and we smell ourselves in the screeching rain of cluster bombs on Iraq. Souls have no worth except red splatters on walls and gobbets of meat and fox furs. "Hey, yo, not me," says the lithe cherub on his skateboard, tearing open a high-protein bar. "Not me," says the sweaty chicken as her beak is sniffed off at the factory farm. "Not me," say the antibiotics heaved into the pig feed with sheep carcasses and blood-clotted paper from slaughterhouse floors. What are souls when small wars are the art form of presidents? Grar.
Maybe it was looking at Mount Rainier. I was, you know, yesterday I took a tour down, not a tour, I went down the coast, past the airport, that is, and I saw Mount Rainier again, and I realized what a thing to see when I was, you know, like 9, 10, 11, 12 years old, delivering a newspaper route in Seattle and looking out there and seeing this ghostly, vast, supernatural, gorgeous brilliance of this mountain out there. And then I went over to West Seattle, where I used to live on 35th Avenue Southwest, and walked up one street and realized I was looking out at Puget Sound and the islands and the mountains in the distance, and that was also what I grew up with. So I think that's really part of it. And then after that, when I was just a little older than that, went to the Middle West and started haunting bookstores and found things like Jakob Burma and Swedenborg, and it wasn't long till I discovered William Blake's work, and I said, whoa, this is speaking to me, or the work of Kenneth Patchen or E.E. Cummings, or also painting by people like Jackson Pollock, and I was interested in biology, painting. For me, consciousness and spirituality all, I can't distinguish between the spirit and matter. They seem to be the same thing to me. Spirit and substance are exactly the same thing.
Isn't that the big revelation of our time? It's the scientists, the atomic physicists are saying the same thing that the...
They're saying the same thing that was said by the Huayan Buddhists in the 9th century A.D., that it's all made out of nothing. Whether now they talk about superstring theory instead of flower garland nothingness physics Buddhism, but it's beginning to sound an awful lot alike.
Yeah,
I'm not like people said in the 60s, you know, when they were doing things like the dancing Wu Li masters or Fritjof Kafka's book, The Tao of Physics. This is at a kind of higher level than that.
Yeah.
And nobody's even remarking about it except you and me right now on the radio.
Here's a spontaneous poem, beginning with lines from the Tao Te Ching for Amy. The beginning of the universe is the mother of all things. We were always together, and my heart sings. I was a big horse with a spotted coat when you called me. And we rode in a boat and on a plane, and we were silk and dirt sprouting with heather. Then we melted, and I saw through your toes. It is always the same story. Here I am in opulent grimness and grizzled glory, free as a leaf in the wind. How I love to sit by you in the movies and see the profile of your nose. The Fanatics. New York City, Beirut, Timor, Baghdad, Dresden, Nanking, Nagasaki, Ramallah, Saigon, London, Kigali. The brave door in the core of your dying, in the screaming and writhing. Brave door, silent door, grar. To glean the livingness of worlds. And Gary Snyder gave me that title for this poem. It's a reply to Rilke's eighth elegy of the Duino elegies. And begins with a quote from Robert Hunter's translation of the Duino elegies. Quote, animals see the unobstructed world with their whole eyes, but our eyes turn back upon themselves, encircle and seek to snare the world, setting traps for freedom. The faces of the beasts shows what truly is to us. Unquote. Now I'll make this mine. With every eye and pounding skulls, beasts see the opening. That's not true. Nor are they in some calm state for a leap to some place beyond the senses' field. Theirs is a less mental shape of cortex, brainstem, and starry tissue. And I've been there. I've dreamed there, in fleshy hell, hoping. Hoping to break time's tissue down and thereby crumple space to bring a heaven near to me. I'll crumple space as all creatures do, dissolving time. There's no clearing out there, no glade. It is all illumined by the arms and teeth that made it and the laugh and cry. My eyes were not turned back upon themselves, but went reaching out through all the wolves and elves that slept beneath my bed and in the corners of my head to outward sweep and draw my love brute back to me. My eyes were solid ghosts projected where the world unfolds. I see no separate oneness in the visages of beasts that is strange to me, except their clarity does not enfold to whirl itself to fireworks that blow my mind with lights and with sights of this doe who stands beside the street in bright headlights of my car, while her two plump, spotted fawns blinked toward my smile. "Hey, you! Hey, dear! I'm on fire. You are more comfortable at some moments because your spirit has fewer swirls and your conscious body lives deeper back in time. Death is beside the point. We're always dead. And in every way, this flesh is every way alive. Our extinction is the proof that we are flames, and the grass fire continues on, lighting up the forest. Dear, you and I are the same stuff, just slightly different mists of spirit. I could almost be your lover. You are almost mine. We're brother, sister. What is this universe that thinks? I always become an animal, as you are always being one. It is one unfolding. It is unfolding one to the other, sister, brother. Blackberry blossoms on the vine, and the fruits of pebbled black and glinting red reach out madly in the air when not trimmed back to accommodate the garden of philosophy. Layer after layer of thorny stalk and leafy stack curl themselves out in sunny morning air that vibrates with the cries of mating hawks. This is almost perfect imitation of the tears of stars creating us, from which we draw our juice or blood, and on the fruit of which we clean our hooves or tap our fin de siècle gloves. So much for sad, pure emptiness, where roses bloom by castle walls. This life is star life. Sister Deer and I see stars with stars. Brother Puma bites his lover's neck, and she sees multi-dimensional shapes of light. What is in space for roses and for berries is the life that's whirling there, within the organelles of cells, and the imagined time they took to crumple selves into a racing thing that's standing in the reins and still beyond the reach of brains. No one ever turned my head back to face away from the world in which I die and play. My body is put in boxes, and then the boxes are surrounded by moving images of boxes, with myself inside of them looking at the moving picture book and TV boxes. These show those who approve or disapprove from their essential teetering groundlessness in almost unconnected boxes, and so forth and on till I might be deaf and dumb. I might forget that I am a swirl of spirit in an ebullient world, and that there is joy. This is joy, that I eat the sun-heated berry, smell the rose, smile at the deer, and flick my headlights off and on to see if she will run. There is a pain if my fingers are pricked by thorns, or if I am crushed by cars or bombs, or if my flame is made to smolder by a sopping blanket of what is numb. If I had a trillion senses, I could tell you why molecules are lies, and what we truly are, and why we build these souls, and what is the perfume that they are. If I had 1,000 trillion senses, I could tell you why molecules are lies, and what we truly are, and why we build these souls, and how, if we may make one, it may help to seal the scar. The garter snake is the sleekest angel that I know, with his simple mind that is inseparable from hunger and an endless history, whether in his spine or great black gleaming eyes. He, like the sea beast beat by waves, is the deep philosopher, and not someone with shears who carves out sculptured emptiness among the scentless roses while pretending he can't smell. We're always there with death. I'm made of death, called particles of matter, and that's one joy of life, that I have beat out entropy and am the whirlwind of a trembling strife. I hold my lover in these arms, and she says my head is a sun for her. Her breasts are universes lying on my arms. We are each other's instrument to glean the livingness of worlds. In each of us is something wild. There are enough mild, dull eyes of domestic brutes that we have bred from bird and beast to make them part alive and partly dead. 1,000 generations in a cage makes a helpless thing, not even quaint like bat-shaped cracks in grandma's porcelain or moon shadows thrown by basil on a garden wall. The ecstatic hunger of the snake is what I filter through this fox of reason as I touch damp moss or steering wheel or laugh at the sky, which is a monster living baby cell, as am I. Or laugh at the sky, which is a monster living baby cell, as are you and I. What we stare out upon or sniff is the whale tooth and the ivory jaw and the sand grain in the pearl, reflecting back the myriadness of this intermingling swirl.
Yeah, I think with nature being forced into non-existence, it's like puts it at such a critical point that it's like that's one of the most intense times to enjoy it and experience it. And I hate to say something like that because what you're doing is you're kissing goodbye to it. But what a great moment to experience the depth and intensity and meaningfulness of it, while, as you say, at the same time, amazing things are being done in the arts, in poetry and painting, and in physics. And I, like you, I see the co-relationship of those. I think I first said, yeah, I'm a poet when I when somebody read me some E.E. Cummings. May I feel, said he, I'll squeal, said she. A poem that started out like that, and I said, that sounds pretty interesting. Sexy. I was in middle of high school. And I went down to the library and found E.E. Cummings. I found those erotic poems of E.E. Cummings. And I said, well, I guess I'm a poet. This stuff's great.
Were you writing at the time?
I wasn't writing. I was making things up, complex verses, and reciting them to people. And it had never occurred to me in any stretch of the imagination that it was poetry. I was just entertaining myself and my friends. And it wasn't until a few years later that I realized that was probably my first poetry.
Were your friends entertained, or did they think you were sniffing dope?
I must have been about 13, 14 years old. We hadn't gotten into dope yet.
Not yet.
Why do I love Alan? A journalist called to me to talk about Alan. Later he phoned back, leaving a message saying he'd forgotten the important questions, like, what are your feelings about Alan? Why do you love Alan? Why do I love Alan? I love Alan because the first time I met him, in 1954, in San Francisco, at a party for W.H. Auden, not only were we the youngest people there, but we were the wallflowers, and we spoke to each other about our visions of Blake and what Blake meant to each of us. I love Alan because of our first poetry reading in 1955 with Gary Snyder, Philip Whalen, Philip LaMantia, and Kenneth Rexroth. Alan read a poem that set the benchmark for deep political social consciousness and for speaking out. In the midst of my personal anarchism, I still return to that declaration of Alan's as an inspiration. I love Alan for introducing me to Kerouac. First to Kerouac's correspondence with him and the sections of Mexico City Blues in the letters, and then later introducing me to Jack personally when they dropped by my apartment in 1955 with a $5 matchbox of pot. I love Alan and Gary Snyder and Phil Whalen and Jack Kerouac and Diane de Prima and Ann Waldman for bringing the mercies of enlightened Buddhism to poetry and to American artists and philosopher intellectuals. I love Alan because I went to heroic lengths to bring him the greatest banana cream pie ever made, carrying it from Fort Collins, Colorado to Boulder for his birthday. Alan took it to the party and it was gone before he even tasted it. I love Alan because of the remarkable generosity with his friends, introducing them to one another and making a free flow of talent and genius. From Bob Dylan to Francesco Clementi to the Russian poets. I love Alan because he nourished some secret grudge against me for 20 years and never exhibited a photograph of me in his recent photo shows. I asked him why last year. He said, "You never let me photograph you naked." You never asked, Alan. I love Alan because when Ray Manzarek and I perform on a double bill with Alan, Ray imagines that he's looking at the Russian Revolution and Mayakovsky, and that we're all going out of the music club and sing and march in the streets. I love Alan because of all of us, especially Alan, competed so fiercely and mercilessly with each other that it made room for all of us to be poets. We had to force new styles and new subject matters for poetry into being. All through this, we supported each other vigorously and single-mindedly. I love Alan for single-handedly pushing the closet door open and declaring himself with such candor and tirelessness that it began the liberation of our gay brothers and sisters. I love Alan for following the CIA day by day in his files and making known the dope running and brutalities of the spy networks. In the same way, I love Alan for the indefatigability of his leadership in resisting wars in Asia and the nuclear waste and the hydrogen armament madness. Alan was well armed with his shining mammal brain, finger symbols, and big voice. I love Alan because I remember us running guard like football players with Bob Dylan between us as a mob of threatening-seeming fans began pursuit in the dim back passages of the San Jose Civic Auditorium. I love Alan because he kept badgering me to sing my poetry. I tried hard and ended up with a musical partner and do my singing as another kind of performance now. I love Alan because he is apparently fearless for his body and went swimming in the Ganges and took drugs that even I was hesitant to take. Alan believes that his body is there to use up with whatever diseases, discomforts, and inflictions. He ignored all of them, endured the suffering, and kept going. I love Alan because when his spiritual master told him that to be taken seriously, he must dress in suits and ties, Alan went directly to the Goodwill and bought a wardrobe. Alan followed that counsel of Chogyam Trungpa's to the last day of his tenure on the planet. But he had some handsome new suits and a Borsellino hat given to him as gifts for a reading in Dublin. At Alan's last funeral rites, Monday, April 7th, at Shambhala Center in New York, at the end of 4 hours of Tibetan chanting, members of the Sangha, the congregation, felt Alan's spirit soaring out of his body and through the pine wood walls of the box he was lying in a few feet from us. That happened right after Gelek Rinpoche directed the burning of a photograph of Alan. Alan, I love you for sailing out so clearly, so energetically, like the love you gave to others over the years, to Peter Orlovsky, to Gregory Corso, to your stepmother, and to so many more. Gate, gate, paragate, parasamgate, bodhisvaha. Nomo samanda motonan oharachi kotosha sononan tojito en gya gya gyaki gyaki unun shifura shifura hara shifura hara shifura chishusa shushiri shushiri sohaja sohaja senchiriga chirie somoko nomo samanda motonan O Arachi Kotosha Sononan Tojito en Gya Gya Gyaki Gyaki Unun Shifura Shifura Hara Shifura Hara Shifura Chishusa Chishusa Shushiri Shushiri Sohaja Sohaja Senchiriga Chirie Somoko Nomo Samanda Motonan O Arachi Kotosha Sononan Tojito en ga ga gaki gaki unun shifora shifora hara shifora hara shifora chishusa chishusa shushiri shushiri sohaja sohaja senchiriga chirie somoko.
That was a Dharani to the Bodhisattva of Compassion, Kanan, and Philip Whalen and I did that Dharani for Alan on the day of his death at the Hartford Street Zen Center, and recently we have done it for the death of Philip Whalen, another great Buddhist poet.
You've been listening to CKUT 90.3 on the FM dial. This is Droma Text, and we're here once a week with the spoken word. Tonight we presented the work of the late Michael McClure, who passed away on May 4th of this year. Michael McClure was a important member of the San Francisco Beat Movement and participated in the 1955 Gallery 6 reading with Allen Ginsberg, where he read his famous rendition, one of his famous renditions of Howl. He was known for his plays, his poetry, his musical collaborations with Ray Manzarek and Jim Morrison of the Doors. He passed away in Oakland last week of complications due to stroke. You can check out more of Michael McClure's work at his website, McClure-Manzarek.com. That's McClure-Manzarek.com. We'll be back next week with another hour-long presentation of the spoken word, and we'll go out tonight with a poem by Michel Lalonde entitled Speak White. Here it is.
Speak White. Il est si beau de vous entendre parler de Paradise Lost ou du profil gracieux et anonyme qui tremble dans les sonnets de Shakespeare. Nous sommes un peuple inculte et bègue, mais ne sommes pas sourds au génie d'une langue. Parlez avec l'accent de Milton et Byron et Shelley et Keats. Speak white. Et pardonnez-nous de n'avoir pour réponse que les chants rauques de nos ancêtres et le chagrin de Nelly Gunn. Speak white. Parlez de choses et d'autres. Parlez-nous de la grande charte ou du monument à Lincoln, du charme gris de la Tamise, de l'eau rose de la Potomac. Parlez-nous de vos traditions. Nous sommes un peuple peu brillant, mais fort capable d'apprécier toute l'importance des crumpets ou du Boston Tea Party. Mais quand vous really speak white, quand vous get down to brass tacks, pour parler du gracious living et parler du standard de vie et de la grande société. Un peu plus fort alors, speak white. Haussez vos voix de contremaître. Nous sommes un peu durs d'oreilles. Nous vivons trop près des machines et n'entendons que notre souffle au-dessus des outils. Speak white and loud, qu'on vous entende, de Saint-Henri à Saint-Domingue. Oui, quelle admirable langue pour embaucher, donner des ordres, fixer l'heure de la mort à l'ouvrage et de la pause qui rafraîchit et ravigote le dollar. Speak white. Tell us that God is a great big shot and that we're paid to trust him. Speak white. Parlez-nous production, profits et pourcentages. Speak white. C'est une langue riche pour acheter. Mais pour se vendre. Mais pour se vendre à perte d'âme. Mais pour se vendre. Oh, speak white. Big deal. Mais pour vous dire l'éternité d'un jour de grève, pour raconter l'histoire d'un peuple concierge, mais pour rentrer chez nous le soir, à l'heure où le soleil s'en vient crever au-dessus des ruelles, mais pour vous dire, oui, que le soleil se couche, oui, chaque jour de nos vies à l'est de vos empires. Rien ne vaut une langue à jurons, notre parlure pas très propre, taché de cambouis et d'huile. Speak white. Soyez à l'aise dans vos mots. Nous sommes un peuple rancunier, mais ne reprochons à personne d'avoir le monopole de la correction du langage. Dans la langue douce de Shakespeare, avec l'accent de Longfellow, parlez un français pur et atrocement blanc, comme au Vietnam, au Congo. Parlez un allemand impeccable, une étoile jaune entre les dents. Parlez russe, parlez rappel à l'ordre, parlez répression. Speak white, c'est une langue universelle. Nous sommes nés pour la comprendre avec ses mots lacrymogènes, avec ses mots matraques. Speak white, tell us again about freedom and democracy. Nous savons que liberté est un mot noir, comme la misère est nègre. Et comme le sang se mêle à la poussière des rues d'Alger ou de Little Rock, speak white. De Westminster à Washington, relayez-vous. Speak white comme à Wall Street, white comme à Watts. Be civilized. Et comprenez notre parler de circonstances. Quand vous nous demandez poliment, how do you do? Et nous entendez vous répondre, we're doing all right. We're doing fine. We are not alone. Nous savons que nous ne sommes pas seuls.
Se pourrais-tu que tu viennes de faire une crotte dans ton vomi? Je vais te dire que j'ai attend tabarnak de raconter ça à toutes mes chums. Ils aiment ça, eux autres, foule de vomi.
Chaud pour le Monstone.